Our study this morning picks up in Genesis chapter 33 and the 15th verse. Jacob and Esau, they're reuniting after a 20-year separation. Jacob has met Esau on the way. Esau has been surprisingly gracious. Are you surprised at the way Esau received his brother? I am. I after 20 years with this man having shown no spirituality at all, that he responded to his brother in such a really tender way. Let's pick up our discussion. We left off last week with the 14th verse, and Esau is suggesting to Jacob after this really precious reunion that he will now go with him back to the land of Canaan, and with his 400, he'll be with him to protect him and watch over him and so on. And Jacob has said, that won't be necessary. I can't drive my flocks or my families as fast as you and your 400 warriors can move. And so verse 14 says, I will lead on softly according to the speed at which my family and my flocks can go. And until I come to my Lord unto Seir, S-E-I-R. Throughout the Old Testament, we see this reference to Mount Seir. And every time we see that, we need to recognize those are the descendants of Esau. There are three words in the Old Testament that describe the descendants on the lands of Esau. One is the word Esau, his name itself. The second name is Mount Seir. And the third name is Edom. E-D-O-M. And when you see any one of those three references, you know that it's referring to Esau and his descendants. Oftentimes, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, the wonderful story in 2 Chronicles chapter 20 about Jehoshaphat, in the 22nd verse, you remember when Jehoshaphat, three nations were mounted an attack against the Jews, and Jehoshaphat sent the praisers out, remember? And God set ambushments to the enemy, and they never did lift their hand in that battle. They praised their way through it. One of their enemies was the children of Mount Seir. It was the children of Ammon, the children of Moab, and the children of Mount Seir. Most of the problems that the Jews had throughout the history of the Old Testament did not really come from the heathen, the Philistines and the Canaanites and so on. Most of it came from the Moabites, the Ammonites. Do you remember who their fathers were? The father of Moab and the father of Ammon? You remember that? Lot. It was Lot with his incestuous relationship with the two sisters or two daughters. Remember they got him drunk, and then in his sleep they fornicated with their father, and the children that were born to the two daughters were Moab and Ammon, and it was the descendants of those two that gave Israel fits throughout the Old Testament history. And then it was here also the children of Mount Seir, which would be the descendants of Esau. So verse 15 then is where we pick up this morning, and let's start with Ken Groom, shall we?
And Esau said, let me now leave with thee some of the folk that are with me. And he said, what needeth it? Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord.
All right, Esau is further offering, all right, if you want me to go on ahead, let me at least leave some of my men with you. And Jacob said, no, that's not necessary. We'll be fine. If we find grace in your sight, you just go ahead and go on and take your men with you. Verse 16, Don.
So Esau returned that day on his way to his field.
All right. And that was the last time they were seen together until they buried their father, Isaac. We'll see that in a couple of chapters. All right. Now, so verse 17 is a very interesting verse. Mary, read the verse, and let's see what we can pick up out of this.
And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built him an house and made booths for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called
Succoth. Hmm. Do you, what comes out of that verse that is strange to you? This is the first house that any of God's men have built, isn't it? Up until now, they have been what? They've been nomads. They've been wanderers. They've lived in tents. Jacob builds a house, and he made booths for his cattle. Booths means tents, coverings, temporary shelters, lean-tos. When the children of Israel celebrated the Feast of Booths, they would go out on the side of their house and they'd make little lean-tos with saplings and tree branches and so on the sides of the house. That's what he's doing here with his cattle. And the name Succoth here means booths. So that's what they called it, Succoth, because of the booths that they'd made. Now, the interesting thing here is that Jacob has no command to build him a house. In fact, he's been told, as was his father and his father before him, that they're to be wanderers in the land, strangers and pilgrims and wanderers in the land. And we're going to find that that's going to create a problem for him in the days that are ahead. Okay? Somebody read then, Lois, read the 18th verse.
And Jacob came to Shechem, the city of Shechem, which is the land of Canaan. When he came from Padan Aram and pitched his tent before the
Lord. You got the good one today. Okay, now for some reason that we don't know, Jacob left the house that he built. He left the cattle pens that he had built, and he moved on towards a city by the name of Shechem. Now, this is not Salem that where Abraham met Melchizedek. Salem, which later became called Jerusalem, which is where the Jebusites lived, is not the same city as this Shechem. This is maybe 25 or 30 miles north of Jerusalem, and it was a city of the land of Shechem. Verse 19.
And he brought a parcel of the field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor. Shechem's father for 100 pieces of
land. Verse 20.
And he erected there an altar and called it.
You want to take a whack at that?
No.
All right. maybe we could get a consensus on this. El Elohi Israel, which means God, El. Anytime you see El, God, okay? God, the God of Israel. That's what that name means. And Jacob, something has happened here to Jacob that is going to create some problems for him in this next chapter. And Jacob has, I don't know whether he got accustomed to staying in one place, you know, all the 20 years that he lived with his father-in-law Laban, whether he decided that was a good way to live or not. I don't know what has happened to him here. But when he returned to Canaan, he had this settle down in him. He no longer wanted to live this nomadic life. And so first, on the way back, he doesn't even come all the way into Canaan. He doesn't return really to the place of his fathers. He stops partway in Succoth and says, well, this is good here. Well, let's build us a house and we'll build us some cattle corrals and pens here and so on, and we'll just kind of settle down here. And then without any explanation at all, in the very next verse, it says he leaves that place where he built the house. We don't know why, verse 18. We don't even know how long this may have taken. But he leaves there and he moves a little further south to the land of Shechem, and which is now in Canaan, and there he buys some land. Now his family, remember up until this point, how much land had his family owned?
Just the burial place.
Just the burial place. That's the only thing though. Remember Abram bought the place to bury his wife Sarah, and that was the only land that they owned. It's interesting here that Jacob would buy a piece of land that God had already given them. God had already given them the whole shooting match.
This experience, of course, he lived 20 years in one place. He moved around nomadic life, would take him here and follow sheep. But he touched God. I mean, when you touch God, that stops your night rambling. He's ready to settle down.
You think that's what's happened here?
Well, the next chapter will tell you this. I mean, I can see Jacob before destroying the whole city when his daughters defiled. But in this next chapter, man, he just used his sons out for, what they, probably should have done.
Yeah.
So I think that experience with God has toned him down. God will tone you down and line you up.
And you think that's why he was wanting to settle down?
That's my, I know when I settle down.
Yeah, I'd say.
It's in rest. It's like you have rest in.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Yes, Mary. Grab a hold of your chairs, girls.
Speaking from a woman's point of view, they're tired. They've been traveling. I don't know how far. I have no idea. And maybe a house doesn't mean like a house that we would say, settled into a house. And the cattle retired. And maybe it's just a place, like I said, of rest for a time. And then move on. But they were tired and they needed a shelter. And in this instant, to do a word study, the house may not be a house as we would, something that you would live in from now.
Quite as permanent, you mean. Uh-huh. But something other than a tent.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I just find that strange that at this particular point that he would decide to do something a little more permanent.
Well, and the Lord may also instill in him that getting that time of the year where he needed to settle in a place during the bad season of the winter.
That's possible. Barbara?
I don't know if you said this or who, but I made a reference at the bottom in the last 17 and 19. Parents, be careful where you pitch your tent.
Yes, we're coming right to that.
You said that?
No, well, I don't know. I don't know whether I did or not, but there is in the 19th verse particularly, before we move to 34, is we do want to make that point while we're here, that Jacob is about to have major problems with his kids in the 34th chapter, major problems. And where did you see this phrase before? In verse 18, where it says, pitched his tent before the city. Where have you heard a phrase like that before? Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom, okay? Jacob pitched his tent toward the city. What does that mean, he pitched his tent toward the city?
He got out of the edge of town.
He got as close as he could without actually moving in the city, that he was right on the edge of the city. He wanted to have fellowship with these people. And he pitched his tent. A farmer does not pitch his tent next to the city. Farmer pitches his tent out where his, nomads pitch their tent out where their cattle eat. And cattle don't eat on the streets of cities. So when a wanderer like this, a nomadic sheep herder, would pitch his tent close to the city, it speaks volumes about where his heart is at that moment.
I see Jacob with a house full of children and two wives and two concubines. He says, I got to settle down and make a home for these kids. This is in the natural. So he's probably securing a place for them while he built that home.
Perhaps. Strange for him to do this next to a city of the Canaanites. And so here he is near this city of Shalem, which is in the land of Shechem. And he is set up his tents on a more or less, not a permanent type situation, but more or less, I'm here for a while, kind of is the impression that we get. But he built an altar there. Now, I tell you what I see here is I see a man who is struggling with his relationship with God, but also struggling with his life here on the earth. He knows God. He's had, as you said, a wonderful experience with God. At this place, he builds an altar to God to worship God, but he's still, while he's had this wonderful encounter with God in which his flesh is broken, the lesson that's in here to me is no matter how broken we get, we're still living in this old flesh. No matter how God has touched us, no matter how wonderfully he has touched us and caused this flesh to come under subjection, it does not go to sleep and sleep for the rest. As long as we're in this body, in the jail this week. Anybody was with us at the jail this week? She had a wonderful service there again this week, and in our message there at the jail, I was speaking in terms of the fact that as long as you're living in this body, I was asking the prisoners, why is it that when you give your heart and your life to Jesus Christ and you become a new creature in Christ, and you get out of jail and, you know, for one thing and another, the first thing you know, you've hit a foul ball and you're back into jail again. What happened? You're a new creature. All things have become new. But the problem is that when you were born again, your hand didn't change, your eye color didn't change, your weight didn't change, the amount of hair you had didn't change, your color didn't change. In other words, we're living in a flesh body that does not get changed. It has to be crucified. And it never really gets completely crucified until when? Until you die. See, then we are at death. We are delivered, aren't we, from the oppressive nature of our flesh. I really think that's what Jacob is dealing with here, that he's had a wonderful breaking at Jabbok with God, but yet his flesh continues as ours does. I mean, no matter how tight you are with the Lord, your flesh does rise up, doesn't it? I mean, sometimes something will come out your mouth and you want to take it back. You wish you hadn't said it. Or thoughts will go through your mind, or you'll do something, and afterwards you say, how could I ever do that? And it is a battle that we fight, isn't it, all the days of our life. And if we walk in the Spirit, the Scripture says, we will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. But it is something that we must endeavor to do every day, and that is walk in the Spirit. Otherwise, that flesh will rise up and bite you, rise up and bite you, rise up and bite you. I think that's really what's happening here with Jacob. That he's a godly man here. He builds the altar and he's acknowledging God, the God of Israel, but at the same time he's pitching his tent right next to the world and wants to have some involvement in there, whatever his motives are. He wants to have some involvement there. Okay, so let's, anybody else before we move to this 34th chapter? All right, even in the promised land, you can have some major disasters. Even when you're living in the land of God's promise, just because you're living in Canaan doesn't mean that everything is going to go smooth. Just because you're right in the middle of the will of God, God wanted him right there in Canaan. Just because you're in the will of God does not mean that your life is going to be, 2 feet on the banana peel. You're just going to slide right through life. Problems happen. Job said, as the sparks fly upward from a fire, so is man born to trouble. In the Psalms, David said, many are the afflictions of the righteous. Frankly, I'm glad for the second half of that verse, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all, you know. So we know God will take us through them. He said in Isaiah 43, when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned. But he didn't say you wouldn't walk through the fire. And he didn't say it wouldn't get hot. He said, you just won't get burned. So the fact is that we do have to walk through the fires. When you walk through the water, it shall not overflow you. Okay? So we are not going to be, the righteous are never utterly cast down. A righteous man, according to the Proverbs, may fall 7 times, but he will not be utterly cast down. In other words, completely and totally lost. So even if we're in Canaan, you know, sometimes we think, this is really something the devil plays with our minds, and we play his game without realizing it when we say about ourselves or someone else. We see someone else in a situation that is troublesome, or we see someone that's got trouble with their children, for example, or, you know, guy lost his job, or, a financial problem, or a sickness, or something like that that people are dealing with while they're here. And we want to think, oh, well, what did he do to get himself in that fix? See, we are just like the disciples in John 9, who, when they saw a blind man, they said to Jesus, who sinned? This man had been blind from the day of his birth. Remember what the disciples said? Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? You remember that question? And don't we do the same thing? See, we look at others in the body of Christ and we see things that have happened to them and we want to immediately fix blame. Well, there may be blame, But just living in this life creates these kinds of things. I mean, it is part of the experience. Why is it part of the experience? Did God mean it this way? No. Why is it part of the experience of this life for us to go through these kinds of things? What happened?
Sin.
The Garden of Eden happened, didn't it? See? And we have a fallen nature, we have a fallen creation. You know, why does the wind blow with such power that people get killed? Did God design tornadoes? See, that's part of the fall. Why, when you go out for a nice walk in the woods in June, do you get covered with chigger bites? I mean, did God plan that? No, see, that's sin. We brought that upon God's beautiful creation. When God created it was good, it was very good. What happened to it? What happened to it was Genesis 3, okay? And so that's why we go through these things. So here's Jacob. He's in the place where he's supposed to be. He's in the place where God had called him to be, and disaster strikes his family. Now, he made some bad choices here, and the worst choice he made was pitching his tent towards Shalem.
I was going to say, that's why we need to be real careful when we share the plan of salvation. That we don't paint this picture of once you get saved, you're not going to have any problems. Right. You know, God's going to take you out of everything and take care of everything, because once a person gets saved that's not known the Lord and not knowing anything about the Lord and Bible, that they do slip. They say, well, I thought being a Christian, you know, would protect me from all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's really discouraging when they realize that they haven't gotten to the verse that says that many are the afflictions of the righteous, and you will have trials and temptations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you said, we've got crucified flesh every day, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
Or that we haven't shared that part with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's really discouraging, and some of them may not ever come back.
And it's in that furnace of difficulty, isn't it, that we really learn that God's faithful. I mean, that's the place where we really find out what it means to be a Christian. That's the place where we find out what the difference is between being a Christian and not being a Christian. Yeah. The one I think about the Apostle Paul. I mean, here's a man who lived this wonderfully effective and blessed life, you know, bringing the gospel to a large portion of the world. And if you read the few verses in a couple of different places in his letters, his life was, while he had the joy of the Lord always, shipwreck, stonings, persecution, you know, everywhere he went. He said, I besought the Lord three times about this. And the Lord said, my grace is sufficient for you. And I think that's important for us to see in Jacob's life that we don't want to be too quick to throw stones at Jacob any more than we want to be quick to throw stones at each other. And you know, that's what the devil does. He works among us, you know, and he convinces us that the reason that this brother is having trouble, the reason that this family is having difficulty, the reason that this sister is having a problem is because of some deep-seated wickedness in them, or some, you know, if they hadn't done thus and so, then they wouldn't be experiencing this trouble. And that's just not necessarily true. I mean, there are consequences to our stupid decisions. That is true. God does not redeem us from those. But the fact that if you just live, Paul wrote Timothy and said, if you're going to live godly in Christ Jesus, you're going to suffer persecution, and that is unpleasant. And that persecution comes in lots of different ways. But we judge each other. And this is the thing that really divides the body of Christ, you know. We want to just throw blame on one another. People in glass houses, I think this ought to be in the Proverbs, even though it isn't, it ought to be there. People who live in glass houses ought not to throw rocks. All right, so who's our next reader? Donna, chapter 34, verse 1.
And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land.
Okay, next, Claire.
And when
Shechem,
the son of Hamor, the Hittite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and laid with her and defiled her.
Trouble, major trouble. Now, Dinah, Dinah is the only daughter of Jacob that is listed in the scripture. We had, Dinah was Leah's last child. Leah had six sons and the one daughter. And apparently, Jacob pitching his tent close by the city, Dinah had gotten some friends. And it says she went out to see the daughters of the land. The impression I get from this is that she went out to have fellowship with her friends, which would be these unsaved Canaanite girls. And while she's out there fellowshipping with these girls, the prince of the country sees her. Now, the word here says that he took her and lay with her, and he defiled her. Of course, we know what that means. But the word took does not indicate here that he raped her or that he took her against his will, against her will. The impression I get from this word took is used many, many times in the Old Testament. One of the places that it's used is God took a rib from Adam. Another place, he took the man and put him in the garden. The word take here does not mean take against the will, okay? The impression I get is that Dinah began to have fellowship with the young people of that community. Shechem was likely to be an attractive young guy. Maybe he would be, let's see, can we draw an example? He would be the blonde, blue-eyed beach boy. Kind of. He's the prince of that area. See, his dad is the king over that whole city. The land is named after him, the land of Shechem. And he would be a real catch. And I get the impression that he begins to show Dinah some attention. And Dinah, either because of her, her curiosity, her innocence. See, she would be a gal not conversant with the ways of the world. She's grown up in a very sheltered and very secure kind of environment, and all of a sudden she's thrown into the fast lane. This is the impression I get. And she begins to draw her friends from that fast crowd, and Shechem begins to show her here she's innocent, she's probably beautiful. Remember, her great-grandmother was so beautiful at 75 that the Pharaoh of Egypt wanted her, okay? Now, this is the kind of line she comes from. So this is, you know, this is very possibly a dish here. And she is smitten with the prince of the city. He is obviously smitten with her. And perhaps they're dating, you know, or when I say dating, you know, they've beginning to develop a relationship. And in the midst of this relationship, he persuades her, and the next thing you know, they're into an illicit relationship, and now she's lost her virginity to this young man. They probably went to the drive-in movies, Lois. They probably went to a drive-in double. You remember those, do you? Huh? They probably went to a double feature drive-in.
You know, something's interesting here. He said he defiled her, but didn't say anything about defiling himself.
Mm-mm.
The Lord calls that, you know, we call it adultery, put a nice word on it, alternate lifestyle, whatever, but God said you defile yourself.
It's defiled,
defile yourself when you do stuff like that outside of marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a better word.
Yeah. It's the indication I get here is that he was probably previously defiled. He's probably not losing his virginity here. She, however, is losing hers.
Defile yourself when you do that.
Strong word.
Saying that more in classrooms, when you do that, you're really defiling yourself.
That's right. That's right. Charles?
You said what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
He was an uncircumcised Canaanite anyway, so she was clean, covered by the covenant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's what you said.
Right. Okay. All right. So now Jacob's got trouble in the house, doesn't he? Now he's got a daughter who has been, the idea I get here is not rape, but rather seduction. Okay.
My Bible said he humbled her.
Humbled her?
Took her, but humbled her.
Yes. Okay.
All right. You know, that's just making her soft toward him, I guess, so he could talk her into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Give give her the Canaanite line, huh? Yeah. So so here's a seduction. She apparently is a willing participant in this situation. But now she's defiled, and he is hopelessly in love with this girl. All right? Who's our next reader?
Verse
Barbara.
Before I read, I just want to, I see just her kind of in a different light. I really think that she, because of where he pitched his tent, that she could see beyond, and I think she would even wanted to be sick. And I think she didn't, that's why her trouble, because she was, you know, 15, 16. And I just, women just kind of know, and she shouldn't have been out there.
That's correct. That's correct. It would be terribly wrong for us to blame Jacob for what happened to Dinah. Because even if Jacob pitches his tent near Shechem, Dinah doesn't have to say yes when the boy says, you know, let's go parking or whatever, you know? And there's also something to be said here for the fact that as Christians, one of the problems that we have raising Christian children is we raise them in a very sheltered environment. We have to also raise them with some warning. You know, if you raise them sheltered, but don't teach them to fear the world, you know what I'm talking about? Then they can be drawn into this. Because let's face it, the world does have its allure, you know. And for most of us, as I know most of our testimonies, we tasted the world first before we ever tasted the things of God, and we realized once we tasted the things that we'd already been snake bit. And then when we tasted the things of God, the things of the world had no appeal any longer because we'd already explored them and found them to be the way they were. But for the children of Christian families that are coming up, they have never tasted, and there is an appeal there. And there is a...
All that is a commercial.
TV does.
Unless you have Bud Light or whatever other light.
Right. Plus the young people of the world, you know. And all of us who have raised kids in Christian homes have dealt with this. And we really need to be sure that we teach our kids that these things out there are to be feared. They're to be feared. They're to be stayed away from. Our children need to be prepared. Let me give you an earthly example of how this works and why it is, I think, that Jesus said, the children of this world are wiser than the children of light. Christian parents think that their kids are just going to they're just going to know, and we don't prepare them. In sales, we always knew that when you're in a competitive situation and you know that you're talking to a prospective customer about your product, you know as soon as you leave, the competitor is going to come in and talk to you about his. So you prepare the customer, you prepare the prospect for the onslaught of the competitive pitch. And you plant the things in his mind to make sure so that when the competitor comes in and begins to lay his pitch on, that the fellow's already prepared for it. He already knows what he's going to say, and has already made his decision that he doesn't want to have anything to do with that, so that the pitch has no power. Okay? That's the children of this world are wiser. We need to plant those things in our children so that when the world comes with its appeals, that the kids already have been prepared for that and already know that that's something they do not want. Rather than, we want to shelter them from it, but we don't want to shelter them from the awareness of it, you know, and the danger of it.
Well, I mean, if you go and teach them right from wrong and truth and from dishonesty, I mean, you've got to go a step further and teach them, you know, these things are going to come up. I mean, you know, that's just part of teaching a child all the way.
Right, but some parents won't even deal with it, figuring that as long as I hide my eyes from this, this will never touch me or my children. And you can't really do that, see? You can't hide your face in the sand. You deal with it, you either prepare your kids for it or you're going to have to deal with it later.
You're saying it's like we're in the world, but not of the world. They have to know that. They can't take them out of the world. They are in the world.
Yeah.
So they're going to face it sometime or another.
Like, don't we teach our children don't play with rattlesnakes? Don't we teach our kids don't touch hot stoves? Don't we teach our children to stay away from the street? Don't we teach our children about worldly dangers? We also need to teach our girls about young Shechems, and we need to teach our boys about young Dinahs. You say, I mean, we've got to talk to our kids about these things. We need to talk to them about the effects of drugs. We need to talk to them about the effects of, of alcohol. We need to not just give them a package of condoms to carry with them. We need to teach them about the moral implications of these things, you know. Now, they go on television, all they hear is, well, you know, if you're going to just be sure you do it safe. Well, there's no way to do it safe, you know. If you do it outside marriage, it's not safe. I don't care how many condoms you use. I'm not talking about physical safety. I'm talking about moral safety and moral and spiritual safety. Mary?
I was just going to say also that in verse 1, that, I don't know, maybe I'm being narrow, but Dinah went to see the daughters, and I'm kind of locked into this. She didn't wait for them to come to her. I mean, come to their house, you know, for them to come visit them. Like, I'm talking about when we were growing up, new people, my mother would never allow us to go to a new person's house until she kind of knew what kind of family they were, what kind of children, how they behaved. And not that she sheltered, so you couldn't have anything to do with this person, but we were nice to them. But she just went out, seems to me like, just she went first.
Yeah.
Think about it being wild.
And, yeah, really like she had a wild hair or something, and she didn't wait, you know, to learn, you know, what.
Oh, I think that's exactly what Dinah's problem was. I think that's what Barbara was trying to say, was that this was a chink in Dinah's, whether it was in her training or just in her basic makeup, she was drawn to that. She wanted to, you know, she wanted to be a part of this painted generation. She wanted to learn all the latest dance steps. She wanted to listen to their records with them. She wanted to go to their films with them. She wanted to talk the trash that they talked. She wanted to be a part of their lifestyle, and she chose that for herself. And when she did, she chose the wrong. Somewhere in the scripture, it says that the companion of fools will be a fool, and that's what happened to her. That she wanted to be a companion of these people, and the next thing you knew, she was apparently her moral underpinnings were swept away, and in the presence of this kind of social interaction, the attentions of this very desirable young man were more than she could bear, and boom, she's done. All right, who's our next reader? Verse 3.
And his soul clave unto, is it
Dinah?
The daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto her.
Well, you know, if there's any redeeming feature about this young man, Shechem, he did love the girl, and he cared for her. This was not a one-time fling for him. He had a real desire not only to have her in a physical way, but he wanted to make her his wife. Verse 4, Charles.
And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this damsel to wife."
Notice he doesn't ask Dinah. Isn't this interesting? He would defile Dinah without checking with anybody, but he wouldn't marry her without checking with anybody because of the custom of the day. I just find that strange, don't you? And so when he wants to marry her, he goes to his father and he says, "How about making an arrangement with this girl's dad? And I want to have her to be my wife." Okay, Ken, verse 5.
And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come.
Okay, we don't know how Jacob got the word, but he did. He was made aware that this had happened, but his boys didn't know about it. His boys were out with the flocks in the field, and Jacob did nothing about it until the boys were come in. All right.
I expect the mothers knew that something had changed in this young lady's life.
That perhaps.
The beans, and she told Jacob.
Perhaps that was where it came from. Mm-hmm. Okay, Don.
And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him.
Okay. What was Hamor communing with Jacob about?
Yeah, it could be a lot of things, but trying to get Dinah as his son.
Okay, that's the deal. He's trying to make a marriage arrangement here. Charles? Perhaps dowry? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of a deal can we make here? My son loves your daughter, and what can we do here? All right. Verse 7, Mary?
And the sons of Jacob came out of the field, and they heard it. And the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had brought folly to Israel and lied to Jacob's daughter.
All right, who's got the anger here? The brothers, Jacob's sons. Eh? When they find out about it, they're grieved. First of all, they're grieved. What does it mean to be grieved?
Mad.
Very, no,
sad.
Sad. They're very sad, okay? They're very saddened by it, hurt by it. Then they became angry. Isn't that the way, isn't where anger comes from frequently? It comes from first hurt. Then it turns to anger. So they're grieved and then angry because that Shechem had wrought folly in Israel, made a fool out of their family. Remember, Israel as a nation is how big at this point? How big is Israel the nation?
It was 60 souls when we went to Egypt, so it's pretty close maybe to that.
Okay, what constitutes the nation of Israel at this point?
Jacob and his son.
Jacob and his family, see? So we talk about Israel now, we're talking about the family. That's really all there is here, okay? So when it says that this man had wrought folly in Israel, means he made a fool of our family, okay, in lying with a sister. This shouldn't be done, all right? Next reader. Lois, are you the next reader? Verse 8, yeah.
And Hamor communed with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you give her him to wife."
Okay, so here the discussion now involves the boys, and Hamor is still trying to make the arrangement for the marriage. Pat?
"And make ye marriages with us, and give ye daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you."
All right, verse 10, Gene.
"And you should dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get your possessions therein.
Uh-huh. So let's make a deal. Instead of just giving us Dinah, your daughter, for my son, let's put our families together here. Let's put our peoples together, Jacob. You make marriage. Look, you got 11 boys. Where are you going to get wives for those boys? We've got lots of women here. Why don't you take for your sons our daughters and make marriages? And we will take your family and join them to ours. You give us your daughters, we'll give you our daughters. You dwell with us, we'll be one people in the land. You dwell here, trade here, make money here. We're going to prosper together. That's the deal, okay?
At this point in time, had the Lord given them instructions not to intermarry?
No. I don't think there had been. Now, they knew it because Abraham, I don't find any place until we get to the law where there was actual, you know, that instruction. But Abraham knew he didn't want. It was a matter of personal conviction rather than the law of God. Okay, all right, Donna, the verse 11.
"And Shechem said unto her father and unto her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes, and what you shall say unto me, I will give."
Mm-hmm. "Whatever you say, I'll do it, because I really want this woman for my wife." Claire, verse 12.
"Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give accordingly as ye shall say unto me, but give me the damsel to wife."
Okay. So whatever it is, I'll do anything that you want. Actually, here out of this story, the sinner Shechem comes out, other than his, obviously he defiled the girl, but his attitude afterwards is more honorable than the attitude of the people of God in terms of his responsibility and so on. Of course, he is...